Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Welcome back to the MTFM Bizcast and our Up for Review segment, where we discuss what's been going on in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Caleb and I are appellate attorneys here at Meisner Tierney, and so we have a particular interest in what goes on in the state appellate court system. Caleb, do you want to start off with a couple of general updates?
Sure.
On what's been going on?
So, yeah, this was the end of the term for the appellate court system.
Yeah, and to clarify for anyone who's, you know, for the non-lawyers, the appellate court term ends at the end of July, right? There's a break where the court goes on vacation, and then it picks back up in September.
Or at least for the Supreme Court. I think the Court of Appeals stays pretty busy.
Technically, the Court of Appeals has an end of term, but you're right. In practice, it doesn't really.
Right. So the new term, technically begins August 1, and then the Supreme Court starts hearing arguments again.
In September.
In September, yeah. So we're going to have a lot to go into with what the Supreme Court did over the last month or so, because at the end of June, they got all the rest of their opinions out for the rest of the year. But scaling out, looking at the Court of Appeals more generally, the first thing we have is in District 1, change of personnel. We mentioned previously that Judge Timothy Dugan's retiring in November. Governor Evers appointed Pedro Colon, who's currently a judge in Milwaukee, to fill that vacancy. And since then, another judge, Judge Connolly, who had announced she was running for Judge Dugan's seat, suspended her campaign. So it looks like Judge Colon will most likely serve a full term. He's running for the seat now, so I think he'll be the newest member of District 1 beginning in November. Moving on, there was also a legislative proposal about the Court of Appeals. So, James, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but the way the Court of Appeals is balanced and split into different districts, do you want to take us through that at all?
Yeah, so I worked at the Court of Appeals for 3 years, and it's split into four different districts. And you'd think that, and there's, I believe, 16 judges throughout the whole Court of Appeals. So 16 judges, four districts, you would think the split would be 4, 4, 4, and 4. It's not. Milwaukee has 4, so that was Milwaukee would be District 1. District 2 has 4. District 3 has 3, and District 4, which includes Dane County, has 5 judges. And if I understand this proposal correctly, it would be to move one of those District 4 judges to District 3 so that we have 4 judges in each district.
Yeah. I don't recall who introduced this proposal, and I'm not sure what the caseload breakdown is by district. I think at one point the rationale for having an extra judge in District 4 was because that's where a lot of the litigation involving state agencies took place. I don't think that's as much the case anymore. A lot of that litigation goes out to District 2 or District 3.
Yeah, you can look up those statistics, I think. And last time I looked at them, my recollection, maybe this is off, was that District 1, which includes Milwaukee, by far has the biggest caseload. So yeah. If anybody needs the fifth judge, it would be Milwaukee.
That's probably true. I don't foresee this going anywhere, but it was interesting nonetheless to see the Court of Appeals, the makeup of the Court of Appeals come up in the legislature. Moving on, this is just another quick thing that the Wisconsin Supreme Court did. There's a rule petition that had been pending for a while brought by the state bar, asking the Supreme Court to amend its CLE rules to allow DEI credits to count towards CLE requirements. And the court denied that petition without a hearing and without really an explanation. It just denied the petition. There was a dissent by Justice Dalit, joined by Justices Ann Walsh Bradley and Karofsky, And they argued that the petition should not have been denied without a hearing, that there should have been a hearing on it. And this prompted a very lengthy concurrence from Justice Rebecca Bradley about the subject. But something to be aware of, the court denied that.
Yeah, and this sort of relates to something I'm going to talk about here in a second. A rule petition, just for anyone who's not familiar with it, it's just essentially a request you file with the Supreme Court to amend certain rules. In this case, the Supreme Court manages the rules and sets the rules for your legal education requirements for lawyers, right? What counts, what doesn't count, how many hours you need. And that was a request to modify those. They're normally not, they're not too contentious, mm-hmm. but the fact you got, I believe you told me it's a 30-page concurrence.
I'd have to double check, but there was an appendix, I know.
So. Yeah, there was the appendix made it much more than 30 pages, but it was quite a bit of writing over something that's not a typical decision. Similarly, we had talked a little bit about the Jane Doe versus the Madison School District case. It was a petition to bypass that got denied. The court subsequently amended the order to include another concurrence, which was very, very lengthy as well. And those two things are just kind of interesting to look at, because a lot of times these non-decisional actions the court takes, in this case denying a petition to bypass, they don't generate a whole lot of discussion. But recently, it seems like there's been a lot of ink spilled. It'll be interesting to see if the guy who runs Supreme Court stats,
Alan Ball,
yeah, has anything to any? I'll be looking on Scow Stats to see if he's got anything to say about the frequency of writings in these non-precedential opinions.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and there's going to be a couple here that we're going to hit really quickly. James, you want to take us into Greenwald?
So Greenwald Family Limited Partnership v. Village of Maquonago, we don't have a lot to say about this. Basically, the court decided that in a special assessment case, the service for the appeal had to be on the village clerk. You couldn't serve the village attorney. And there's not too much to discuss beyond that.
Yeah, I agree.
Caleb, you want to talk a little bit about Miller versus Zoning Board of Appeals?
Definitely. So this unanimous Dalit decision, and this actually was argued by a good friend of mine, Zach Sibley, over at Axley, who formerly clerked for Justices Dalit and Krofsky at the court in recent years. So he's been in practice less than a year. He argued this case at the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which was cool to see. But you'll recall this case was a situation where the village board considered a modification to a zoning ordinance to allow what had been zoned as a residential property to be used for commercial purposes. I think a Dollar General was going to go in or something like that.
It's some kind of a convenience store is my recollection.
Yeah. And it was contested by someone else who owns a store in the area. Turns out the people who owned the property and stood to benefit from the change in zoning, their mothers on the village board. So an argument was made here. Well, it's a violation of the due process clause for the village board to rezone this property with the mother of the people that decision is going to benefit sitting on the board. The argument was this is a bias problem.
But bias problems only apply to like decision, like adjudicative things like a court. You have a right to an impartial decision maker in your judge.
Yeah. And that's ultimately what the court held here. There's a very, very brief opinion, well done opinion. And I think it was pretty much, it boils down to what Justice Dalit said in paragraph 14. Legislators are partial to legislation all the time. Indeed, they often run for office promising to use legislative power to accomplish specific policy objectives. Now, we should make the point, zoning is legislative in nature, even if it's affecting a specific area.
Yes.
And that's what was going on here. So zoning is legislative. These are essentially the village board. They're essentially legislators. And surprise, surprise, politicians are biased, and the due process clause doesn't have anything to say about that.
Correct. And I recall that our discussion on this was relatively brief, other than the interesting fact of, the mom being on the board. But we looked at this, and I believe our conclusion was this is an act of legislation, essentially, and the due process clause is going to apply.
Yep. Yep. So no surprise here.
I guess we should move on and touch on the Wisconsin property taxpayers case.
Yes. So this is a case that has to do with how local governments can fund road projects. And I believe, yeah, this is another unanimous decision. This one authored by Justice Rebecca Bradley. And what we had here was the town of Buchanan, some number of years ago, kind of sprung up all at once and laid all its roads in a relatively short amount of time. And they're now in a situation where they're working to replace all their roads, and it's really expensive. And there are these things called levy limits that limit how much a local municipality can tax property in the district. And the argument, so what happened here is the town of Buchanan set up what they call the Transportation Utility District, which is this entity responsible for maintaining the roads in the community. And then they funded it with what they called a transportation utility fee. So instead of having your typical property tax that's based on the value of your property, there was this fee that charged, I believe it was like a flat rate for residential properties. If you have a residential property, you have to pay this much towards roads. And then for commercial properties, it said, we're going to assess how much traffic you have at your property. And if you have more traffic, you're going to pay a higher fee. The idea being kind of a use fee. If you contribute more to the use of the roads, then you're going to pay more to maintain the roads.
And essentially, this is an attempt to try to get around the levy limits because the Buchanan couldn't raise enough taxes to fund his projects.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court, so this was a case argued by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The statute, they clearly thought was pretty clear because Lucas Weber argued this case. And he was given 30 minutes at oral argument to make his case. And after 16 minutes, he had said his piece and said, unless the justices have any more questions, I'm going to sit down. And he won, which was a smart move to advocates. If you have a strong case, you don't need to dig yourself into any holes by talking too long at oral argument. But the court said, look, this property tax, because that's what it is, you're taxing properties based on how they're used, results in the municipality taxing the property at limits higher than the levy limit. And that's not allowed. Even though you found a creative way to do it, that's not allowed. Now, there was a concurrence by Justice Bradley. So Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote the majority, and then she also wrote a concurrence on her own behalf, joined by Justice Rogensack, where she said, oh, by the way, this also violates the uniformity clause in the Wisconsin Constitution. So the Wisconsin Constitution has a provision that says property taxes in the state have to be uniform and they have to be ad valorem. They have to be based on the values of the property. This is not based on the values of the property. It's based on the traffic going to and from the property. Therefore, it violates the uniformity clause.
So it was invalid for a different reason in addition.
According to Justice Rebecca Bradley, and I think it's a strong argument,
yeah.
But a majority of the court, I assume, thought, you know, we don't need to get to this in order to decide the case. Therefore, we're going to avoid this constitutional question. So that's more or less what happened there. I don't think is there anything more to add on that one, James?
No, I think you about covered it. I guess the next case we should talk about is the Sanders v. Wisconsin Claims Board.
All right, take us into it.
Yeah, this is that wrongful imprisonment case where the question was how much money you receive as compensation from the government if they wrongfully imprison you for 26 years, which is what happened in that case. Wisconsin has enacted, and for quite some time actually, since 1913, has a statute that establishes a claims board that fields these claims from people who are wrongfully imprisoned. They have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they were wrongfully imprisoned. And once they meet that threshold, then the claims board is going to determine whether to give them any compensation subject to the statutory scheme. And so the issue here is that Mr. Sanders, it was determined by the claims board that he was wrongfully imprisoned for 26 years. He goes to the claims board with his request, and there's a limit that the claims board can award. It's $25,000, which if you divide that by 26 years is not really much per year. It's less than $1,000 per year. Mm-hmm. But the claims board can recommend to the legislature to award a higher amount. And that was really the issue because Mr. Sanders presented his claim to the claims board and they just gave him the $25,000 without addressing his claim that the $25,000 maximum was inadequate. And his argument was one that, you know, as you'll see, I agree with, that the claims board was required to determine the amount that would adequately compensate him, not just, you know, award him up to the $25,000. And if that determination that the claims board makes is that $25,000 is not adequate, which I think it's pretty hard to make the argument that $25,000 is adequate compensation for 26 years, then the claims board would have to make a report to the legislature telling the legislature, here's the amount that we think would adequately compensate that prisoner. And then the legislature gets to decide whether to appropriate that money and compensate the prisoner.
So this is really interesting. I mean, let's just take a moment to appreciate the procedural posture of this case.
Absolutely.
So you have, and we touched on this last time we talked about the case, you have a wrongfully convicted individual who is asking the judiciary to order a commission, the claims board, which I guess that probably falls under the executive branch. I'm not entirely sure.
I believe it would. It's tasked with administering the law, but it does perform some adjudicative functions. Like it's deciding, yeah, has the petitioner shown that they're wrongfully convicted and what amount is reasonable, yeah, compensation.
So, but it's weird because normally the legislature decides that normally you'd have a legislative allocation of funds for these sorts of things without the claims board. So not sure quite what the claims board is, but to my point, you have this defendant asking the judiciary to order the claims board, an agency, to write a report and send it to the legislature. And the case doesn't get into this, but James, that kind of sounds like a political question to me.
Well, the question, if it goes to the legislature, it clearly is a political question. Yeah. And prior to the claims board, that was sort of your recourse, is you would go petition the legislature and say, hey, I was wrongfully imprisoned. Can you guys compensate me? And it was treated like that. And the statutory scheme still does kind of treat it like that, right? But it does give the claims board just a little bit of a leash. It's like, well, you can award up to $25,000, but if you're going to lay out some serious money, you got to send that to the legislature along with your report.
So it's just, I mean, and this is totally just a detour. It's not what the case was about and not what the court should have gone into, but this is a report that helps the legislature decide how to set policy. What is more political than that? I just have some questions about whether this is where a space the judiciary should be acting. But set that aside, James, go ahead and take us into what the actual dispute is. What's going on here?
So this really comes down to a very particular reading of the statute involved. So the statute is 775.05, and it says that if the claims board finds the petitioner was innocent, the claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner not to exceed $25,000 and at a rate of compensation not at greater than $5,000 per year of imprisonment. And it goes on. And finally, at the end, in a separate sentence, says, if the claims board finds that the amount it is able to award is not an adequate compensation, it shall submit a report specifying an amount which it considers adequate to the chief clerk of each house of the legislature. So if it finds the compensation is inadequate, then it sends a report to the legislature, right?
Yes.
That's the statutory language issue. Now, the majority reads that and says, well, if the claims board finds that the amount is inadequate, then that triggers the obligation to do that. But it doesn't require the claims board to actually make a determination of whether the compensation is adequate.
Now, before we get into James roasting the decision too much, we should note that Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote this, and it was a lead opinion joined by Chief Justice Ziegler and Justice Rogensack. Justice Hagedorn joined in the conclusion, but did not join the opinion itself.
Yeah, and I think that actually for the non-lawyers, what a lead opinion is kind of, let's explain that for a minute. It takes a majority of the court to make a binding opinion, but sometimes you don't get a majority of justices. You get justices voting for an outcome, but for very different reasons, and you know one rationale has a majority of the court. In that case, there will be what's called the lead opinion, which is sort of, well, it's the lead opinion. It kicks things off, and then you'll have a concurrence, and those votes will amount up to the majority needed for the mandate. But neither opinion is binding because it doesn't command a majority of the court.
And it gets really messy when you're trying to. When we as lawyers are trying to figure out what the court said, it gets really difficult.
Correct.
Yeah.
So you were about to talk about the concurrence, I think.
Well, I wanted to stay on the lead opinion for a second there. Okay. And I guess basically both of them reach kind of the same. Both the lead opinion and the concurrence do the same legal move. They look at the statute, and the statute says if the claims board finds that the amount they can award is not adequate, then they have to file a report. But what they don't see in the statute is a statement that the claims board must decide whether this $25,000 was adequate compensation. Therefore, it is just a conditional if the claims board decides to find that the amount is not adequate. But the claims board, in the lead opinion's view, and the concurrence's view, can't be reasonably read to impose that.
Exactly. Duty. Exactly. And so essentially under the lead in the concurrence, if you come to the claims board with saying I've been wrongfully imprisoned and they say, yep, we agree, they don't have to do anything other than, you know, at most hand you a check for $25,000, the limit. They're not obligated to engage in any analysis of whether that's an adequate amount to compensate you. And I remember when we were talking about this, I thought the court was going to go the other way on this because of the text.
I agreed with you.
You agreed with me slightly more tentatively, so you were slightly less wrong than I did.
I was nervous. I think I ended up agreeing with you. Initially, I thought you were correct on the outcome, but that outcome would be wrong. But as we work through this and the statutory history, which we'll get into in a moment,
yeah,
I was inclined to think that the dissent got the better end of this, the legal argument.
Yeah, I agree. I think both of us agree with the dissent here. And basically the dissent looks at the language and says, look, there's an obligation in here that says the claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner, and the not to exceed $25,000 and not at a rate greater than $5,000 per year, that's not a limitation or a restriction or that doesn't get them out of their obligation to make an equitable determination on the amount of compensation. They've got to figure out what's the amount that will equitably compensate the petitioner for the wrongful imprisonment.
Yeah.
And I will say in defense of the lead in the concurrence, if all we had was the text here in sub 4, I see the argument because the $25,000 limit and the $5,000 per annum limit they're in the same sentence, even though they're not in the same clause. So you can make a decent enough textual argument. I still don't agree with it, and neither of us did at the time. But what really seals the deal for me is if you go to the original version of the statute.
This is the statutory history argument.
Statutory history. Yep. So we're looking at how was this statute originally enacted? How has it kind of changed over time? And the reason why that's often relevant is if there's an intentional change in meaning, you can see that intentional change in meaning, like clauses deleted or something like that. That helps you interpret the current statute. But also, if the language pretty much remains the same and there's no indication the legislature wants to change anything, we actually have a statute that says we presume that the meaning stays the same. Yep. And so sometimes what you can do, and what I think is the case here, is you go back to the original version of a statute, and that first draft of the statute before the language changed makes it much more clear for whatever issue you're looking at. And I think that's very much the case here. If you go to the 1913 statute, which is when this was enacted, once the claims board determines that there's clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner is innocent, the board shall proceed to find the amount which will compensate the petitioner for his wrongful imprisonment, period. Then there's a new sentence. Such board may award a compensation to the petitioner so found innocent, not to exceed $5,000 in any case. So the limitation
the
on
the next one that really is the big deal.
Yeah, because so the limitation on the amount that it's very clearly talking here about the amount the commission is able to award. The determination of adequacy and the limitation on the amount of the award are two different sentences. The following sentence, you're right, is the real kicker. If the board finds that the amount they may be able to award will not be adequate compensation to the petitioner, they shall report an amount to the legislature which they shall deem to be adequate.
Yeah, so it's the step one, step two. And if you look at the 1913 law, that context seems to make it really clear. Step one, find the amount. Step two, if that amount is beyond what you can award, report it to the legislature. And in fact, the Attorney General's brief here admitted that the 1913 law, if that were the law today, would have required the claims board to act. But then argued that the statute had been amended since and that change fundamentally changed the meaning. I didn't buy that argument. So the court or the lead opinion here, it doesn't buy the AG's argument that the meaning of the statute changed and during the subsequent amendment. Instead, it simply says the 1913 statute did not require the board to make a finding regarding the adequacy of the statutory maximum compensation. And I'm struggling to see that in the 1913 language.
The only argument I can see in support of that is the fact the first sentence said the board shall proceed to find the amount which will compensate, and the conditional sentence says, if the board shall find that the amount they may be able to award will not be adequate. So sentence one doesn't use the word adequate, but I don't know of any other way to read this sentence as, you know, what do you mean find the amount which will compensate? Well, find the amount which will adequately compensate. It's clear, you know, if any amount, if there's no determination of adequacy, why are we determining the amount which will compensate? Like, I don't see a meaningful difference. I think the AG's interpretation of the 1913 statute is correct. I think were we under the statute, I don't think there should be any question that Sanders is right. He presents his claim to the board. The board has to at least address his claim that the $25,000 was inadequate. And if it says, nope, $25,000 is adequate, a decision I don't think would be very reasonable, then okay, sure, it doesn't have to send a report to the legislature. But if, as I suspect they would had they analyzed it, if they concluded that that's an inadequate amount, the statute would require them to send that report to the legislature and put that firmly in the court of the legislature so they can make the policy decision of whether or not to.
Court of the legislature. That's a little bit of an oxymoron.
The ball in the court. Yeah, I know. It's sort of a bit of a pun here because we're talking about
which goes back to like whether this is a remedy that courts should even be awarding.
Yeah. Anyway, now, that wasn't addressed by anybody. The question wasn't. Like, all right, let's assume that Sanders is correct on the statute. Is the remedy to order the claims board to make a determination, maybe in writing or whatever, some indication that it considered the claim, and then if it finds the compensation inadequate, then we're ordering you to send a report to the legislature?
That'd be weird. I mean,
I don't know if it would be that weird, but it does raise some questions, and the remedy issue didn't come up. And the dissent, which I agree with, didn't really go into a lot of detail either. The dissent just simply, don't want to misquote it, the conclusion I think is pretty clear. It said that, you know, what the dissent would have done is required the board to follow the legislature's directive to determine whether or not the statutory maximum is adequate and explain its reasoning such that the court can review and Sanders can understand the rationale behind its determination. Basically, make a decision on it and then show your work so that we can judicially review it. What's assumed there is that there's a judicial review of it.
And the majority, or the lead, I guess, got into that a little bit. And that was part of the reason Justice Hagedorn didn't join the lead, I think, is because it reached into reviewability. The lead opinion went on to say that this just isn't a reviewable issue. And I think you run into hairier questions if the court is going to be regulating what sort of work the claims board has to show, like the dissent is suggesting here. So I'm not sure that I'm with the dissent on that point. Like, to what extent can you tell the, to what extent should a court be telling the agency to show its work in a way that the statute doesn't explicitly require the agency to do so?
Yeah. And that is where Justice Hagedorn's concurrence would decide it more narrowly. He agrees with the reading of the text, but he doesn't want to get into the reviewability of the findings of the of the claims board. But it was a very interesting case, one that we thought was going to go a different way, but ultimately...
I do have two other things on this case before we move on.
By all means.
So one is something, a quirk in Justice Rebecca Bradley's lead opinion that is kind of a practice pointer. So Justice Bradley, in two occasions, paragraph 17 and 46, she cited to the Wisconsin Bill Drafting Manual. And I think she's done this before, but it's not, I haven't seen it very often. And I'm not sure how I feel about it. She cites to the Wisconsin Bill Drafting Manual for evidence of how a statute should be interpreted. The Wisconsin Bill Drafters Manual has a bunch of rules for the attorneys sitting over at the Legislative Reference Bureau drafting bills. And it says, use these words if you want to do this. Don't use these words if you want to do that. And it's just a list of rules.
Yeah, it's interesting to resort to that because that's very clearly an extrinsic source. It's not intrinsic. It's not like statutory history or text. And in a very strict textualist analysis, there could entirely be something I'm missing about this. You wouldn't resort to those extrinsic sources. Now,
We do, like with dictionaries. Is this different than a dictionary or citing to Scalia and Gardner? And I don't think it is. I think it's basically the same. The concern that I have is if you're referencing the Wisconsin Bill Drafting Manual from 2023 to interpret a law enacted in 1913, for example. And you have to line up the Bill Drafting Manual for the year of the enactment.
But that kind of gets to my point of why this really isn't like citing Scalia and Garner or a dictionary, because it's a moving target. You know, this is a document that the Legislative Reference Bureau, the agency that typically takes the laboring oar in drafting legislation for to be debated on and whatnot. This is something they've produced that's current as of a particular year.
But it's also not legislative history. I don't think it's not.
No, it's not.
It's a publicly available resource that helps us figure out what words most likely meant. So I think in that sense, it's the same as looking at a dictionary from 1913 to figure out what a statute written in 1913 means, if you're going back to the 1913 drafting manual.
Was there a drafting manual back in 1913?
I have no idea. But it strikes me as not totally sensible to look at the current drafting manual to figure out what an old law meant, right? What an old law meant. Anyway, main reason to bring it up is I would consider this fair game. If you're briefing an argument to the Wisconsin Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals on a statutory issue, it's probably worth perusing the Bill Drafting Manual to see if there are any arguments you can make in there.
I mean, I think it would be good practice anyway. I mean, whether or not it complies with the strictest version of textualism, I think it's a good source if you can find a contemporary version of it. And it tells you at least why lawyers at the LRB currently may be using the words that they do.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that.
So I don't get me wrong. I think it's a good source.
Yes, I agree. The one other thing I wanted to mention on this case, and I think it deserves mention because it captures, we see a lot of, when there's disagreement in cases, especially hot button cases, we see a lot of resort to sometimes ad hominem attacks. Sometimes just this person just doesn't get it. But some of these questions are really hard. And this case presented a hard question. I think, you know, the statute, I waffled on it as I reviewed it. And it's important to recognize that judges aren't just doing policy work. And two judges engaging in good faith to try to figure out the meaning of a statute can reasonably disagree. And Justice Hagedorn brings this up in his concurrence. So we didn't really touch on it, but the lead opinion has a pretty robust critique of the dissent. taking it to task for its interpretation of the statute, arguing that it's relying on policy reasons. Paragraph 52 of Justice Hagedorn's concurrence, I'm going to read it in full because it's got a nice complement to the parties here. Additionally, the lead opinion engages in a lengthy critique of the dissent for allegedly rooting its conclusions in public policy rather than law. While I reject an approach to statutory interpretation that incorporates one's preferred policy outcome, I simply do not see that in the dissent's analysis. The briefing on both sides of this case was excellent, and in my view, the dissent presents a well-reasoned, good-faith reading of the statute.
And correct reading of the statute.
That wasn't in there. Sometimes judges endeavoring to faithfully interpret statutes disagree. No nefarious motive need be invoked. Although I disagree with the dissent's analysis, the critique by the lead opinion misses the mark. And I mean, I think this just so much of law, especially when you get to the Supreme Court, involves close questions where reasonable people can disagree. So I really appreciate this particular paragraph to highlight this is a difficult question. James, you and I argued about it a lot. And
I argued about it yesterday.
and I think it's good to have some judicial acknowledgement that attorneys can do a really good job. Questions can be really close. People can disagree. But all of that is part of a good faith effort to figure out what the law is and apply it faithfully.
I think we've probably spent enough time on that. You want to move on to the Alsop case?
Sure. All right. Alsop, another fascinating case, potentially with significant implications for Wisconsin law. We're not going to dive into the facts all that deeply. Basically, what happened here is there was a sale of a broadcasting company, I believe, or of their assets more specifically. And there were multiple entities that provided advice during this transaction. Very complicated transaction. So for our purposes, all you really need to know is you have a party getting advice and you have two defendants giving advice. And one of the parties settled out and the other party did not settle out. The other defendant did not settle out. So there was a trial between the plaintiff and the defendant that did not settle. And the question here, the primary question, the one we're going to talk about, is whether you can admit evidence that the plaintiff settled with another defendant during the trial. And James, the longstanding rule for admissibility of settlement evidence, law school 101.
Yeah, you can't. The whole idea is, as an incentive, partially as an incentive to encourage settlements between parties, we don't admit the fact of settlement, generally the amount of settlement, and certainly not the settlement communications to prove liability, right? You know, you don't want to have to be worried that, in an effort to, play nice and negotiate with the other side, some word you say is going to get taken out of context and then used against you later, right? Yep. And that you learn that in law school, you get the impression that that rule is inviolable. It's like, scripture. You can't, the fact of settlement and settlement negotiations are inadmissible.
And in this case, we have a 4-3 decision authored by Justice Hagedorn admitting a settlement agreement. And the reason for doing so is there's a statute, section 90408, that says basically settlement evidence is not admissible to prove liability or invalidity of the claim or its amount. Okay. That's the longstanding law school rule James was talking about. But then it goes on to say that this section does not require exclusion when the evidence is offered for another purpose, such as proving bias or prejudice of a witness. And so that's the key. So another purpose, such as proving bias or prejudice of a witness. And there's this case from 2000 called Morden, which was a unanimous Justice Prosser decision, that says the party may demonstrate prejudice or bias by showing that a witness changed his or her testimony. And then it goes on to say, or that the posture of a settling party was significantly different as a result of the settlement. And basically what Justice Hagedorn does here, joined by Justices Dalit, Karofsky, and Ann Walsh Bradley, is say, more or less. We're applying a deferential standard of review. Morden says that change in posture of a settling party is a type of bias or prejudice, such that you can admit settlement evidence. Therefore, the circuit court did not erroneously exercise its discretion by admitting the settlement with the other defendant. Any reactions to that, James?
Well, my initial reaction was kind of surprise because you just default as a lawyer to like settlements aren't admissible. However, in defense of the majority, slightly, and I speak to this because I haven't thought about it quite as in great detail as you have. The statute does say that this section does not require exclusion of the fact of settlement, or really anything with respect to settlement, when the evidence is offered for another purpose, such as proving bias or prejudice of a witness. And so I think the operative, just looking at the
exhaustive.
Text, the operative inquiry is it being offered for one of the prohibited purposes? Are you trying to use it to show that another party is liable? Or has admitted liability or something like that? Or are you trying to show bias, prejudice? And I think you could probably show, you could use it to impeach them as well, potentially, just so long as it's not the prohibited purpose. Now there's more to it than the text. There's, you know, that text wasn't enacted in a vacuum, but I look at that and that text is a little bit of a surprising thing for me to read. It seems to open the door pretty wide.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of hinted at it already. I guess I don't buy this. I think you have, when you're admitting a settlement as evidence that a party has changed its litigation posture, what are you trying to convey to the jury? You're trying to convey to the jury, not that the party is biased towards itself, right? Every party is biased towards themselves. And you're not trying to prove that they're prejudiced towards themselves, because again, every party's prejudiced towards themselves. So I guess I'm struggling to see how the posture of a settling party, and this is, I mean, Morden did this back in 2000, so it's not new, how the posture of a litigant changing due to settlement equates to bias or prejudice of a witness. I mean, maybe you're – yes, if a plaintiff was initially saying that a defendant should be held 50% liable, and then after they settle with another defendant, they say that the first plaintiff – or the first defendant should be 80% liable, okay, then you're maybe impeaching, but you're not proving bias or prejudice. That seems weird to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a big part of the dissent was pointing out that this significant change in posture concept introduced by Morden essentially applies to every single Perringer release, where you release one defendant and are litigating against the remainder.
The exception totally swallows the rule here.
Yeah, and so I guess I think I see that, and I think I agree with that. But I look at the text of the statute and I'm like, well, is that what the statute is doing? Does it actually just create an exception? And it's a use restriction, not a general restriction. So the way the majority is generally speaking reading the statute is, well, the statute is primarily about purpose. It's not about we're going to default to excluding it. The dissent is reading it as we default to excluding all this stuff. There are exceptions to bring it in. That's why I brought up the context that the statute was enacted. One thing I would have liked to have seen that I just don't know off the top of my head and I didn't have time to research independently is how similar is this language to other statutes? Like, is there an analog in the federal rules of evidence? I know there is, but how similar is that language in the federal analog? And then how have other courts done that? Because legislatures do not adopt text in a vacuum usually. It's possible they decided the only thing they wanted was a use restriction on this, but that would seem a very odd thing to take place that wouldn't make lawyers all over the state very, very unhappy and very, very loud when that was proposed.
So there is a federal rule. I looked into this a little bit after we chatted yesterday. Federal Rule of Evidence 408 has the exact same exception, so 408B. The court may admit this evidence for another purpose, such as proving a witness's bias or prejudice, so on. So it's the same language in the federal courts. And I confess I did not do a deep dive, but I didn't find anything parallel to this, where kind of as a matter of course, you can use the fact that a party settled out, that a plaintiff settled out with one defendant and is now going after just one other defendant as a basis to admit a third party settlement.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's case law that's addressed it.
Yeah.
And I guess that bears mentioning is the situation that the dissent is talking about is really only comes into play where you have multiple defendants who the plaintiff is claiming are jointly responsible for the injury and you're settling out with some of them, but not all of them.
Which happens frequently.
Yeah. It's not uncommon, but it's not every case. It's not like, oh, if you sign a settlement agreement, this, you know, Alsop says that it's just going to be admitted as a matter of course. Well, only if there's a way that it can be used to show bias or prejudice or something like that. In the context that this case is dealing with, it's the changed incentives that are created when one party settles and there are other parties, other defendants remaining. So,
yeah. Anyway,
you know, I would be more interested in the sort of the lawyers who deal with this more often and what their reaction is. Is this a sea change? Is this something that's really, you know, dismal to their practice? I'd just be interested at what the kind of what the lawyers think about this one who deal with it.
I'd be curious what mediators think about it. When you have mediators handling complex cases involving multiple defendants, a frequently used strategy is to work on bringing together a pot of money to settle the case and then perjuring out with anyone you can get. And that, I think, isn't going to work as well anymore because the plaintiff is going to be more reluctant to settle if the other defendants are going to be able to go to trial and argue, look, this plaintiff already got his settlement funds.
And that gets at a point you made yesterday. The fact of settlement is really being used against them to suggest.
Oh, yeah.
To suggest that you should be, you know, I should be less liable. It ultimately is going to a liability issue, even though, but it's because bias affects liability, right? You know, to the extent you're trying to say, you can draw that conceptual line between proving bias and proving liability, but from the standpoint of the settling plaintiff, hey, the fact I settled is now going to be thrown at me as a weapon.
Yes. I think this is going to make it more difficult to settle cases, and plaintiffs should be very aware of this case going into settlement conversations. Yeah. All right. So that wraps up our discussion of Alsop. James, you want to take us into the last case, 5 Walworth?
Sure. 5 Walworth versus Engerman Contracting. This is an insurance law case that involved, you know, a general contractor and then a subcontractor who built a pool. There's allegations that the pool was improperly constructed, developed cracks, and ultimately had to be destroyed and torn out and reinstalled many years later. And the headline issue here was whether or not it was really the initial grant of coverage, which is fancy speak for, you know, if you look at the coverage provisions of the policy, it's like it's near the beginning of the policy. On its face, does the policy cover the loss? Sometimes there are additional exclusions and other provisions that'll exclude coverage, but it's that initial grant. And there was a case called Pharmacol that concluded that property damage to your own property, the insured's own property, was not property damage under a liability policy. And that was more of a sort of, I don't want to say public policy, but it wasn't very closely connected to the text of the
policy. Drew on tort law, right?
Yes, it did. And it incorporated this tort test of an integrated systems test and said, well, once your property or your product goes into gets combined with other property such that it's an integrated system, so it all becomes one thing, it's now your property, and any damage to that isn't covered as property damage under a liability policy. So what the majority did here is the majority actually reversed Pharmacol and said, no, we're going to look at the policy language, and the policy language in your standard liability policy doesn't mention integrated systems. It doesn't mention damage to other property versus your own. And so therefore, we're going to say that there's no requirement that the damage be to property other than your own to fall within that initial grant of coverage. I didn't dig into that, that deeply. The analysis sort of tracks at a high level. Now, for people who practice insurance law a lot, that might initially sound really counterintuitive because typically CGL policies don't cover damage to your own property. But what the majority was careful to avoid deciding is they weren't addressing any exclusions for damages to your product or your own property. Those are pretty common exclusions in CGL policies. So basically, you're not going to get, as an insurer, you're not going to, deny coverage now based, on the initial grant and say, well, there's just no initial grant of coverage to damage to, your property, which is now part of this integrated system. Instead, that issue is going to be dealt with in exclusions. Now, that does change things a little bit because the insurer has the burden to prove that an exclusion applies, whereas the insurer doesn't have any burden to disprove the initial grant of coverage. So it does change it. So there were a couple of separate writings there. There was a concurrence by Justice Rogensack, who actually authored the Pharmacol decision. And then,
She wasn't thrilled with being overruled.
Yeah. I mean, quite understandably. And then, so Pharmacol was 2016, I believe.
It was 2016 after Chief Justice Ziegler and Justice Rebecca Bradley were already on the court, but they didn't participate.
Yeah. So it was a 5-justice decision in which Justice Ziegler and Justice Rebecca Bradley didn't participate. And Justices Rebecca Bradley and Justice Ziegler wrote a partial concurrence and a partial dissent.
In this case we're talking about?
In this case.
Oh, in this case. My bad. I was looking back at Pharmacol.
Yeah, no. So in this particular case, and the loan issue they dissented on was the issue of whether or not this was a known loss. So basically the pool had been constructed in, like, I think 2012, and on again, off again had been leaking. And so the way these policies are, without getting too deep into the language, if a loss was known and existed prior to the beginning of the policy period, it's generally not covered. And so they would have partially reversed on that issue because one of the insurance policies at issue, they had made that, the insurer had made that argument. But it's interesting that I think you had 6 votes, if you count them up, that were good with reversing Pharmacol, which wasn't that old of a case. I mean, that's 2016.
And no one had asked for it to be reversed either, which was interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
But everyone seemed on board with, look, this is just not consistent with the rest of insurance law as how we've done it as a state.
So yeah, at least at a high level, that analysis tracks somewhat. I think, Justice Rebecca Bradley is very in tune with how insurance policies work. Mm-hmm. Her writing consistently demonstrates a deep understanding of the intricacies of it. So I feel a little bit more comfortable saying, yeah, the reversal of Pharmacol kind of tracks in my mind. Because if there was an alarm, she's typically one of the justices that would point out flaws in the textual analysis of those policies. And to the extent the majority opinion here is pushing the court towards a more text-focused reading of insurance policies, I'm generally in favor of that.
Yeah.
Usually you see courts going oftentimes you see courts going the other direction where they're not reading the policy language very carefully and more crafting a result that quote unquote makes sense in light of the party's expectations.
James, it sounds like you handle some insurance coverage.
Yeah. Work. Yeah. I do a fair bit of coverage work. And so I'm always hesitant to express any agreement with a decision that goes against any insurer. But this is one I'll dig into a little bit more. Maybe I'll have some additional thoughts on it at some point, but it was an interesting case.
Would you say it's fair to say that this is less of a seed change in insurance law and just kind of more a closing of the Pharmacol era, but it probably won't affect outcomes too terribly much?
I'll defer to people who deal with these like kind of property damage liability cases a little bit more. I've dealt with them some. My experience is more like kind of the mass tort and environmental contamination. So I'll be interested as I converse with my colleagues what their thoughts are on this, if anything. But it didn't initially strike me as being like a sea change in the law. You know, it's not like saying that your property and your product exclusions are invalid or we're not going to apply them. It was simply saying, well, this analysis of whether or not it's your product, it's going to go in the exclusion when we analyze the exclusion, not when we analyze the initial grant of coverage.
Yeah. All right, James, I think that wraps up our inaugural term of covering Wisconsin Supreme Court cases.
Celebratory noises.
We're hoping to be back in August to do a little bit of a term recap, potentially bring aboard a special guest. We'll see how it goes. Otherwise, we'll look ahead to the next term, which begins in September, and we'll be back next term to cover all the cases and oral arguments as they come through.
Yeah, and we thank you all for listening and sticking with us through the term. As always, feel free to contact us with questions, comments, or other shots from the Peanut Gallery at our email addresses, which can be found at our website, mtfn.com. And until next time, I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner Tierney Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.